Welcome to the Denver Community Church Teaching Podcast. We're so glad that you're joining us today from wherever you are, whether you attend one of our Denver locations or listen online. Our hope is to explore and participate in the life of Jesus so that we can be a healing presence in our world. As you listen to this teaching, allow it to begin a conversation between you and God, you and the Bible, and you and your community. If you have any questions about DCC or this teaching, you can email us at info@denverchurch.org. And if you'd like to financially support our community and beyond as we set aside 20% of every dollar given to support our partners locally and around the globe, you can text the words Denver Church to 77977. That's Denver Church to 77977. Thank you for joining us today.
Morning. Good to see all of you. If you'd like to follow along today, we're going to begin our time together in Matthew chapter 1. This is the first Sunday of Advent. And so we're going to spend the next four Sundays talking about the four matriarchs that we find in Jesus' genealogy, the four women who he descended from, and what they can teach us, not only about Jesus, but also about us. And so with that said, I'm going to begin reading in Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1. It says, "This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron, Hezron, the father of Ram, Ram, the father of Amminadab, Amminadab, the father of Nashon, Nashon, the father of Salmon, Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Solomon, the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam, the father of Abijah. Abijah, the father of Asa. Asa, the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, the father of Jehoram. Jehoram, the father of Uzziah. Uzziah, the father of Jotham. Jotham, the father of Ahaz. Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh. Manasseh, the father of Amon. Amon, the father of Josiah. And Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon. After the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel, Zerubbabel the father of Abihud, Abihud the father of Eliakim, Eliakim the father of Azor, Azor the father of Zadok, Zadok the father of Akim, Akim the father of Elihud, Elihud the father of Eleazar, Eleazar the father of Mathan, Mathan the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, and Mary was the mother of Jesus, who was called the Messiah. Thus, there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to Messiah." Some of you right now are like, this is the most boring introduction to a sermon I've ever heard, because it's genealogies. And it's a bunch of names that we would never expect to hear. Although I'm convinced that today everyone wants such a unique name for their kid, some of you will probably pull a couple out of there. And we'll have to meet baby Alvahood in a few weeks. Nonetheless, it's boring. And if you read the text, especially in the Hebrew scriptures, what you will find is that there are actually genealogies everywhere. Luke, in his gospel, also brings forth a long genealogy. But what this points to is the fact that we as human beings have long wondered and been curious about where we come from, who our family is. Now, today we don't do genealogies. Today we do 23andMe. And what's interesting is when 23andMe started, they thought they would sell 1,000 kits in the first year, maybe if they were lucky. And yet, through their advertising and their sales push, they sold 10,000 kits in their first week. Why? Because we want to know where we come from. Somehow that matters. Somehow it tells us something about who we are right here and right now in our world today. Several years ago, I called my dad and said to him, "I want you to come to Denver and I want you to tell me the story of your family." Now, my mom's family was Irish, so there was no language barrier, and it was pretty easy to hear stories. Most of them we kind of figured out pretty quickly were fabricated and exaggerated, but I kind of liked that. And I got to know my grandfather and my uncle and everybody else on that side. But my dad, when he came over from Cuba, he was 15 years old. There was a lot of trauma in his leaving the country. And so growing up, he never really talked about it. And not only that, but there was always the language barrier of all of my aunts and uncles and grandparents who spoke Spanish, and there was difficulty communicating. And so a few years ago, I said, Dad, I want to know the story of my family. I want to know the story of your family. Why? Because it does something. Something we can't quite explain. And in hearing his story and the story of my family, it awakens something in me. Like, oh, half of me is actually Latino. This is why next summer when I'm on sabbatical, I'm spending the entire sabbatical retracing my family's story through Cuba and all the way back to Spain, because I want to know. In the ancient world, the way that they did this is they would tell stories about the ancestors, and then they would also put together lists of ancestors so that you would know who you were, and if you were reading about someone, you would know who they were. And this is exactly what we have here. And the reason we're focusing on Matthew's genealogy in particular is that it does have something that's interesting. I'm not going to say it's peculiar, because it wasn't uncommon to have women's names in the genealogies in the ancient Near Eastern world. But if you had said to the Jewish people to whom Matthew was writing, there are four women from the Hebrew scriptures that are featured in the genealogy of the Messiah, almost every single one of them would have said, oh yeah, we know who it is. It's Sarah, the wife of Abraham, Rebecca, the wife of Isaac, and Leah and Rachel, the wives of Jacob. Because these are the four matriarchs of Judaism. But Matthew doesn't feature those four. Matthew features four other women who are considered to be heroines, who are considered to be courageous, who are considered to be powerful and women of honor. And these are the ones that he features, and these are the ones that we'll look at over the next 4 weeks. The first one being the story of a woman named Tamar. And her story happens in Genesis chapter 38. Now, I want to point out, as we go way back in the Genesis 38, that this story happens somewhere, depending on who you listen to with dating it, somewhere between 3,500 and 5,000 years ago. Which means this is centuries before the prophet Moses, who leads the people up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. This is long before there was Torah, or God's words and laws given to the people of Israel. There was no nation of Israel. At this time, when this story happens, most people believe that things were not written down yet. They were only shared orally. They were told around the campfires. And this is the place that we're in. And I point this out because these stories that we read can be troubling, can be baffling, can leave you wondering, what kind of book is this? Because what's interesting is the Bible, especially in the Hebrew scriptures, when it tells stories, doesn't offer a defense or a perspective. It doesn't say if it's good or bad. It just says, here's what is. And it's interesting that we stand and look back 4,000 years and we have all kinds of attitudes and opinions and judgments about how backward it was and how primitive it was. And we probably should if it's 4,000 years old. But let's not forget, 4,000 years from now, what are people going to think about us and our culture? We have to remember we're looking back at a place that's a very different world in a very different time. Now, I don't say this as a defense. I just say it as an observation, because I know a lot of people who say things like, man, I can't do the Bible, just too tribal and violent, misogynistic, and besides, I'm binge watching Game of Thrones, I don't have time. Yes, the Bible sometimes is primitive and backward, and curious, and confounding, and troubling. All those things are there. The thing I appreciate about it is this: it doesn't sanitize that, it just puts it out there and says, what are you going to do with it? And so let's keep that in mind. 4,000 roughly years ago, this is the story that unfolds. It says, at that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hira. There, Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her and made love to her, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son and named him Onan. She gave birth to still another son and named him Shelah. It was at Kizib that she gave birth to him. So now we all know where that is. Judah got a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, his second son, "Sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that the child would not be his, so whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death also. Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "He may die too, just like his brothers." So Tamar went to live in her father's household. After a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah to the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend Hira the Adullamite went with him. When Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear sheep," she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that though Shelah had now grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. When Judah saw her, Tamar, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not really realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, "Come, now let me sleep with you." "And what will you give me to sleep with you?" she asked. "I'll send a young goat for my flock," he said. "Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it?" she asked. He said, "What pledge should I give you?" And she said, "Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand." So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite in order to get his pledge back from the woman, but he did not find her. He asked the men who lived there, "Where is the shrine prostitute who was beside the road at Enaim?" "There hasn't been any shrine prostitute," they said. So he went back to Judah and said, "I didn't find her. Besides, the men who live there said there hasn't been any shrine prostitute here." Then Judah said, "Let her keep what she has, or we will become a laughingstock. After all, I did send her this young goat, but you didn't find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result is now pregnant." Judah said, "Bring her out and have her burned to death." As she was brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. "I am pregnant by the man who owns these," she said. And she added, "See if you recognize who seal and cord and staff these are." Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her my son Shelah." And he did not sleep with her again. That's messed up. Now here's what's interesting, among other things, is the placement of this story in the larger narrative of Genesis. The book of Genesis is really the prologue or the backstory to the book of Exodus. And the book of Genesis is really the story of the people of Israel and their ancestors, namely Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And if you read through the book of Genesis, most of the book and the stories up until this point are about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But then it turns towards Jacob's sons. And here we have a story including Judah and Tamar, his daughter-in-law. Now, the reason I say the placement of the story is curious is because in Genesis 37, we're introduced to Joseph. And many of us are familiar with Joseph thanks to a Broadway play called Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. Joseph was the second youngest son of Jacob, but the one that Jacob loved the most. So much so that he gave him a special garment. Now, exactly what that garment represented, there's a lot of debate around that. But it really set him apart as his son, his favorite son. Now, if you're a parent and you have more than one kid, they have no doubt asked you, who's your favorite? Has anyone experienced this? Yeah. I always say to the kid that asks me that, you are. Because typically their siblings aren't around. And then it makes them feel good, even though it's probably not true. I do have a favorite, however, but I'm not going to say who it is. But this Jacob made no qualms about this. He just said, he's my favorite, and gave him a coat. And Joseph, by the way, didn't help his case. Joseph is the youngest, second youngest of much older brothers. And he starts having these dreams. And not only is he having the dreams, he's telling his brothers about the dreams. One of which is, he says, I had a dream that there was a bunch of sheaves of grain. And you were the sheaves of grain, and you were bowing down to me. They're not fans of that dream. Joseph has another dream where he says, the sun and the moon and the stars all bowed down to me. The sun and the moon representing his mother and father. Even then, Jacob gets a little bit upset. We learn in Genesis chapter 37 that Joseph is snitching on his brothers. It says that he tells his mother all the wrong his brothers did. Joseph is just this little squirrely peon that's favored by his dad that drives everyone crazy. I happened to love him because I'm the youngest of six, and I resonate with a lot of the things he said and did, including telling my brothers about dreams I had in which they bowed down to me. So one day, Joseph, who's hated by his brothers, loved by his father says, Joseph, go out and check on your brothers. They're in a few towns over tending sheep. So Joseph goes, and his brothers see him coming, and they say, let's kill him. And then Reuben, one of the older brothers, says, no, let's not kill him. Let's just throw him in a cistern, which is like a huge well. And let's leave him there. And Reuben thought, we'll leave him there, and then I'll get him out later and bring him home and tell him to shut his mouth and not be so, you know, bragging about all these things. But Reuben, as they're eating lunch, gets distracted. And a caravan comes, and Judah says, you know what? Let's sell our brother to the caravan and then fake his death and bring his coat back home with animal's blood on it, and dad will never know. This is our introduction to Judah. A devious, evil person. Because later, that crime of selling your own family into slavery is considered a capital offense, meaning it warrants the death penalty. But this is how we meet Judah. So they sell Joseph off. And then the Ishmaelites who buy him sell him into slavery in Egypt, and boom, we find ourselves right in the middle of the story of Judah and Tamar. So when it says, at that time, Judah went down to Adullam, it means at the time Joseph was being sold, Judah left home. He watched his father mourn the death of his brother, and he just played it off, and he left home. And he goes, and he gets married, and he has a son. And we learn the first thing about the son is that he was evil in the Lord's sight, and God killed him. And then there's a really curious part, where Judah says to his second son, marry your brother's wife. Now, this is very common in the ancient Near Eastern world. It's called levirate marriage, and it goes back long before the Jewish people, into Mesopotamia and into the Hittites. And the idea was this, is that if you were a man and you died before you had an heir, then your brother was responsible to marry your widow so that she could have an heir and she could have protection and she could have rights as the mother of the child. And the child, the first heir born to your brother's wife, actually got the inheritance of your brother. And so many point out that Onan didn't want to get Tamar pregnant because he would lose his share of the inheritance that was now his. And he does what's evil in God's sight, and it says God kills him. And so far, Judah's kind of 0 for 2 with having good sons, which is a way of pointing again toward Judah's evil. Judah's not a good guy. And we see that even more when he decides not to give his youngest son to Tamar, and there's a little quote in there, he says, or else he might die too. Jewish historical books say that Judah and his wife believed that the reason the sons were dying was because of Tamar. So not only is Judah a bad guy, he's unable to see what he's doing, and he pins it on Tamar. He makes her the scapegoat, and then he sends her back to her father's house and says, someday I'll give you my youngest son, but he has no plan to do it. The responsibility to make sure that the widow is taken care of and protected and has rights and everything else is the responsibility of the father of the sons, not the father of the bride. And so what we see is Judah is now withholding the rights that come along with where Tamar is. He is oppressing her. He's pushing her off to the side. He's forgetting about her. In this story, to be clear, Judah is the villain. And everything we learn about Judah up until this point is that he is not a good person. Is that he is a liar. That he's guilty of committing capital offenses. And he puts Tamar away and just thinks, man, if I forget about her, everything will be fine. But it's not. We learn that his wife dies. And Tamar begins to piece together that she is going to be without rights. She's going to be without a son. She's deprived of what is owed her. She deserves a child according to the law of that day. So what is she to do? Now, it's interesting that when we read this, we often read it through our, well, we always read it through our lenses. So there's a lot of commentary out there about Tamar. I mean, this is a woman who was a widow, then she posed as a prostitute, and then she got pregnant. Naughty, naughty, Tamar. But when we read this, we don't read it, or we read it with our lenses, and we don't read it with the lenses of that culture and that time. There's a lot of stories that are beginning to reemerge, thankfully, that are the stories of heroines, that are the stories of females who are heroes, and it looks much different than the stories that we are used to of men as the heroes. Keep in mind that women in this day and age were so pushed to the margins. They were so disadvantaged. They were looked at as property. They were expected just to do what the men wanted them to do. And so the heroines in the ancient context looked much different. And thanks to the work of women like Maria Tartar and Sylvia Pereira, we're beginning to hear these stories again. And this is one of them. And so we come to this with our morals and say, well, this was very incorrect, Tamar. But keep in mind that what was happening in her context was the deprivation of rights, being oppressed, and all of this happening at the hands of one man whose name was Judah. And so she hears that Judah's going up to a certain town, and she decides to take matters into her own hands. So she takes off her widow's clothes, she puts on some other clothes and wears a veil, and she sits there and waits for him to arrive. The reason she's waiting for him is he is the one that owes her a child, not his son. And we learn what kind of guy Judah is, because he sees her and says, hey, let's go sleep together. And she says, what are you going to give me? He says, well, I don't have anything now. But he gives her his seal and the cord and the staff, which is unthinkable in that time. Because the seal was basically your signature. Your seal was the thing that carried your name, carried the weight, and the cord was what you would use to put it around your neck so you could always have it in safekeeping. And the staff was a symbol of authority and power. Judah was so quick and so willing to give those things away to fulfill his own urges and needs. And he sleeps with her. One rabbi says that Judah cared so little for his daughter-in-law that even in the most intimate of interactions, he didn't recognize her. That's how blinded he was. And then he leaves. Now, he does make good on the promise. He sends a goat. But when he realizes that there's really no prostitute there at all, what does he say? Well, let's not go back. We don't want to get laughed at. Everything about this guy is so egocentric, so wrapped up in his own world, so consumed with his own self and his own urges. And so the story in his mind is over. Except for 3 months later when someone says, hey, your daughter-in-law is guilty of prostitution and now she's 3 months pregnant. And we see how cold-hearted he is when he says, burn her. No questions, nothing. Just burn her. And then Tamar, in a brilliant, brilliant move, says, okay, you can, but I have one question for you. Who do these things belong to? The rabbis observe that Tamar is a woman of virtue because in that culture, she still refuses to shame her father-in-law because she says it directly to him. In other words, she's kind of discreet about it. She says, Who's these? In the line that makes the story complete, he says, surely you are more righteous than I. Now, the word righteous there is also the same word that's used or translated for justice. So he says, surely you are more just than I. Surely you're more righteous than I. Surely you care more about what is right and good, that what is the way things are supposed to be than I do, because I wouldn't give you my son. It's fascinating that we can come to the story with all sorts of perspectives, but in the ancient world, it's showing that Tamar is the one who carries the cause of justice within her, not her father-in-law, Judah. There's a great commentary on this by Dana Fuel, and she says this, Judah did not know Tamar when he sent her away to her father's house, and he did not know her when he lay with her. When he does come to know her, it is more than he cares to know, for she forced him to know himself. It's a fascinating perspective because ultimately the question becomes, well, what's next? What happens in the rest of the story? Well, we learn that Tamar has two sons, has twins. But we also seem to learn that this somehow becomes a turning point in the life of Judah. Judah, who is the one who sold his brother into slavery. Judah is the one who raises sons that are so wicked that they're killed by God. Judah, the one who oppresses and alienates. We actually see a different Judah in the chapters following this, which is why many say that this story is right here, because it basically shows us the shift in character or the shift in the way Judah chooses to live his life. And we see that because Joseph, if you know the story, goes down to Egypt, is sold into slavery through an incredible series of events, ends up in the highest ranks of power. And there's a famine that breaks out in the ancient Near Eastern world, but Egypt is prepared for it. And so Judah and his brothers decide to go to Egypt. And they go there to get food, and Judah promises his father Jacob that he will be the one who will guarantee the safety of the youngest son, because he knows Jacob can't bear to lose another son. Judah, the one who sold his brother into slavery, is now the one saying, I will protect him. And we see that again when they threaten to enslave Benjamin in Egypt, and Judah says, no, don't enslave him, enslave me. Jewish commentary points out that what we see here is a revolution or transformation in the life of Judah, and it happens in the moment that a woman of courage and honor stands up and says, these are yours. And that's when he says, you are more righteous than me. Judah actually becomes, as we learn, chief among his brothers. He becomes the one that is the chief of the tribe, so to speak, even though he's not the oldest. And we see this when he's given the blessing by his father Jacob, when Jacob dies in Genesis chapter 49. And Jacob says, Judah, a ruler will one day come from you. And then Jacob says this to his son. The scepter, or the staff, will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of nations shall be his. Now, Jewish commentators and Christian commentators alike see this verse, and they say, this points toward the Messiah, because the Messiah will come from the tribe of Judah, will come from the man of Judah. It says, the scepter will not depart, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of nations shall be his. Because the staff is a symbol of authority. Who held that staff for 3 months? Tamar, thank you. I love when I ask for responses from all of you. You're always like, did he ask a question just then? I really want to answer, but I'm not sure it was a question. Sometimes it's rhetorical. Yes, Tamar held that staff for 3 months. And in her holding that staff, she transformed the life of the one to whom it belonged. And Jacob blesses Judah and blesses that symbol and mantle of authority that was transformed by a heroine, a woman of courage and honor and dignity named Tamar that transformed the life of Judah. Matthew begins his genealogy, And the first woman he introduces us to is Tamar. Why? Because where we come from is important and it matters. And when we begin to understand the lineage of Jesus, we need to know these stories and see these people so we're deeply aware of who he was and where he came from. And one of those ancestors, one of those mothers, was a woman who, though she was disadvantaged, displayed dignity and power in subverting the narrative in her day and her cause and belief in justice and righteousness. It's the same kind of heart, by the way, we see in Jesus. A heart that is consumed with righteousness and justice. Things being made right. The world being put back together in a way that God would want it to be. This is the story of our mother Tamar. A story that no doubt informed Jesus. And my hope is it is a story that will no doubt inform and challenge and shape us. So that we may live together in a way that's more like her. Let's pray together. God, we thank you for these bizarre stories that have been handed down over thousands and thousands of years. Stories that in our modern sensibilities don't make much sense to us. Stories that continue to challenge us and confuse us. But I ask that we would continue to give ourselves over to them, to find ourselves participating in them so that we might know more what you wish to teach us through the lives of those who came before us, including our mother Tamar. We thank you for her courage. We thank you for her strength. We thank you for how she challenged the status quo of her day and how her example is there to teach us more about who Jesus is. We pray these things together in the strong name of Jesus. And all my brothers and sisters said, amen.